Who is Aung San Suu Kyi, and how appropriate are her international credentials as a pro-democracy hero? Was her pro-democracy activism truly grassroots, or did she have help from Western centers? Why has the Rohingyan crisis suddenly erupted in mainstream media and political consciousness? What geostrategic significance does Myanmar play in the region, and how is that affecting world response to the Rohingya crisis? Who is the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army, and what connection do they have with the Saudi Kingdom? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we take a closer look at the Rohingyan crisis in Myanmar and how it may be used to advance certain imperial aims. Our guests include journalist and broadcaster Stephen Lendman, as well as writer and Mint Press News contributor Whitney Webb. On this week's program, Downfall of an Icon, Aung San Suu Kyi, the Rohingyans, and the Bigger Picture. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 22nd, 2017. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Israeli historian Avner Cohen, as well as the award-winning U.S. journalist Seymour Hersh, have confirmed the existence of the so-called Samson option, wherein Israel will deploy its nuclear weapons if it feels its security is threatened. During his speech at the UN, Netanyahu alluded to the Samson option in saying, quote, "Those who threaten us with annihilation put themselves in mortal peril. Israel will defend itself with the full force of our arms and the full power of our convictions." In this sense, Iran has much more to fear from Israel than Israel has to fear from Iran. Yet, ironically, it is Israel that continually protests about its own fears. That comes from the article, Fact-Checking Benjamin Netanyahu's General Assembly Speech by Adam Gary, posted September 20th, originally appearing at The Duran. The Kurds are allied with Syria's fiercest enemy, Israel, whose planned Greater Israel project coincidentally aligns almost perfectly with the Kurds' plans for Kurdistan. In the Oded Yunan plan, which is the plan for a Greater Israel, it states the imperative use of Kurds to help divide neighboring countries in order to aid in their plans for greater domination. Interestingly enough, Kurds brush this alliance off as being just another step in achieving their ultimate goal of creating an autonomous Kurdistan. Every major Kurdish political group in the region has long-standing ties to Israel. It's all linked to major ethnic violence against Arabs, Turkmens, and Assyrians. That comes from the article, "Amidst universal opposition to KRG referendum, Israel stands by Kurds," by Sarah Abed, posted September 20th. The United States of America is the world's greatest superstate with the largest economy and global GDP. It possesses the most powerful military machine in history, backed by the largest arsenal of nuclear weapons in existence. Its sidekick in the Middle East is the State of Israel, and they work in concert to exert disproportionate influence on both the global economy and international politics through their combined position in the United Nations and through the economic and political power of the Likud-leaning U.S. Congress. All this is done publicly with no attempt to hide this blatant bilateral U.S.-Israeli agenda. That agenda is to overtly increase the economic and political power of Washington to the exclusion and at the expense of the other 191 member states of the United Nations General Assembly that includes Britain, Germany, France, Spain, and Italy, among others in Europe. That comes from the article, the UN, Trump, and Netanyahu. When did democracy, justice, and equality just disappear? By Anthony Bell Chambers, posted September 20th. According to the Israeli spokesperson, the establishment of a U.S. base in Israel will send a, quote, message to the region, unquote. Whether that's perceived as a positive message or a message of U.S. imperial expansion remains to be seen, but by most accounts, it's likely to be the latter. If anything, the establishment of a U.S. base in occupied Palestine could help to reinvigorate the international pro-Palestinian activist movement, which traditionally has had an anti-imperialist message in its mission. Generally speaking, it's hard to see how such a move by the U.S. can be seen as a positive development for the region. Add to this other direct provocations by the U.S. on behalf of Israel, and we have a recipe for potential disaster down the road. That comes from the article, A New Provocation, U.S. Establishes First Permanent Military Base Inside of Israel, by Patrick Henningsen, posted September 20th, originally appearing at 21st Century Wire. There are bills designed to further punish and discredit the already weakened PA, deny funding to UNWRA, outlaw the BDS movement, and recognize through clever sleight-of-hand language Israel's control over the territories. The Trump administration, which began its tenure proposing to deliver, quote, a great deal, unquote, to end the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, has reportedly lowered its ambitions to a proposal mirroring a long-discredited 40-year-old Likud concept of, quote-unquote, limited Palestinian autonomy, denying Palestinians full sovereignty and any rights in Jerusalem, while releasing large areas of the West Bank to Israeli expansion. Netanyahu, the Likud, and their neoconservative allies can rightly claim that the vision they projected for the Middle East in a clean break is being realized. But in reality, what they have created is an unsustainable mess that includes a weakened and dependent PA that was denied the ability to govern, causing it to lose legitimacy, a fractured Palestinian polity with Hamas in control of a humanitarian disaster in Gaza, an Iraq in shambles and, in its wake, an empowered and emboldened Iran, and a metastasized terrorist threat that now challenges many countries, and a hardened, though divided, Israeli electorate from which it is unlikely to see any new peace-oriented leadership emerging. So this is the house that Bibi built. That comes from the article, The House That Bibi Built as Prime Minister of Israel, by James Zogby, posted September 19th, originally appearing at Loblog. Trump's address may be similar in some respects to George Bush's 2002 State of the Union speech designating North Korea, Iran, and Iraq an axis of evil. In March 2003, war on Iraq was waged on the pretext of non-existent WMDs. War plans against Iran were prepared, similar ones ready to attack North Korea, neither implemented so far. Trump is hostage to hawkish generals running his administration's geopolitical agenda. Instead of being a peace and stability leader, he's the latest in a long line of U.S. warrior presidents, at war in multiple theaters, threatening more conflicts, risking possible nuclear confrontation with North Korea, Russia, and/or China. That comes from the article, Trump's UN address to call for action against non-existent North Korean and Iranian threats, by Stephen Lendman, posted September 19th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. She's been called the Asian Mandela. Aung San Suu Kyi, the daughter of General Aung San, a Myanmar independence hero, spent much of her youth abroad. She returned to Myanmar in 1988, at a time when students, office workers, and monks were rising up by the thousands against then-dictator General Ne Win. Claiming to draw inspiration from the nonviolent struggles of Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King, Aung San Suu Kyi organized and led rallies across the country calling for democratic reform and free elections. The rallies were suppressed by the military and Suu Kyi placed under house arrest. The leader of the National League for Democracy was recognized for her pro-democracy efforts, which earned her a Nobel Peace Prize in 1991. Her iconic status only continued to increase as she would spend much of her time from 1989 to 2010 under house arrest, even denied access to her sons and husband during the early years of her detention. Victories in the 2012 parliamentary by-election secured major gains for her party, the NLD. She took on the role of opposition leader. Then in 2015, her party won an overwhelming majority in parliament. Suu Kyi is barred constitutionally from assuming the office of president, given her son's status as UK passport holders. Over the last year, and particularly recent weeks, Suu Kyi's sterling international reputation is becoming tarnished as word of ethnic cleansing and brutalization of the minority Rohingya population is getting out. There's open talk of having her Nobel Prize rescinded. In Canada, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is facing pressure to have Suu Kyi's status as an honorary Canadian citizen revoked. Mainstream media and politicians may be a little late in the game when it comes to critical reportage on Aung San Suu Kyi's background. Here with me to discuss the international community's fascination with the Myanmar icon is Stephen Lenman. He is an independent journalist, blogger, and broadcaster with the Progressive Radio Network. He's a Project Censored winner and recipient of the Mexican Journalists Club International Journalism Award. He's also the editor of and contributor to the 2014 book Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. From Clarity Press. He's also a frequent contributor to Global Research and a frequent guest on this program. Stephen Lenman, welcome back to the Global Research NewsHour.
Michael, it's wonderful being on with you. The Rohingya is certainly a big issue. It's an issue that I had only addressed once a couple of years ago, and then more recently I wrote a couple of articles on it. I'm not an expert on the area or the conflict or anything that's going on. But I had my say in two articles, and it really is a hideous situation. These poor people for decades, literally for decades, have been viciously persecuted by the Myanmar government. Over a million people. I think it was a good many more, maybe hundreds of thousands more than this. I think currently about 1,100,000 or so population in Myanmar. Hundreds of thousands fled across the border to Bangladesh. They're certainly not given a warm welcome there. The kind of refugee camps that get set up, whether it's in Bangladesh or most other countries, are pretty deplorable places. In France, they were deplorable places. You can imagine what they're like in Bangladesh. But the Rohingyas are being slaughtered, and Aung San Suu Kyi, a Nobel Peace Prize winner in 1991, a generation ago, simply is totally unsympathetic to their plight.
Now, I did notice that you wrote an essay back in November of 2015, just before the elections, which saw Aung San Suu Kyi's party, the National League for Democracy, rise to power. You were critical of Aung San Suu Kyi way back before anyone was talking about the Rohingyans, it seems to me. Is the Rohingyan crisis your principal source of skepticism about this widely praised figure?
I have not looked into exactly what she's doing in the government. I think the only way you can get along with the regime in Myanmar, Michael, really a junta regime, is you either go along with them or you run into a great deal of trouble. Well, Suu Kyi was under house arrest for a good number of years. She herself went through a lot of persecution, and suddenly she's a leading figure in the government. I don't think she really has much power. The generals pretty much decide what they're going to do, regardless of what she will do or say or whatever. But if she doesn't go along with them, then she'll probably end up in big trouble with them. So she does that. I don't know how much of a shield her Nobel Peace Prize is. It certainly helps more than not having it. But she desecrated the award, just the way most of the others do. The awards are usually made to war criminals. And since Suu Kyi is complicit with the war crimes and crimes against humanity, against the Rohingya people, she's a war criminal.
Okay. I know that there was a fascinating report, and you actually cited it in your 2015 article It's from 2006, Burma Campaign UK, which is a London-based group campaigning for human rights, democracy, and development in Burma, as they put it, which is what Myanmar was called before 1948. And the report seems favorable to the kinds of reforms Suu Kyi was calling for and involved in, but it also takes pains to mention funding for groups aligned with her. These include George Soros's Open Policy Institute and the National Endowment for Democracy, groups heavily aligned with Western, particularly U.S. imperial aims. I'm wondering, knowing this, if the involvement in these quote-unquote democracy-promoting activities from abroad affect your estimation of the movement aligned with and behind Aung San Suu Kyi?
Well, of course, Michael, the so-called democracy-promoting agendas are very undemocratic. Anything the NED or Soros or like-minded people and groups are involved in want to subvert democracy, not promote it. And apparently Suu Kyi is very accommodative on preventing real democracy in Myanmar, which would be impossible given the junta running things. It's a repressive regime. America courts the country, China courts the country, other nations court the country, and Suu Kyi is used as a national icon. But her iconic status really is phony, given the way she operates. And a speech she gave just a few days ago, she made the astonishing claim that the government is really using legal tactics to deal with the Rohingyas. She also, earlier, in a statement she made to a UN humanitarian individual, that he should avoid using the term Rohingya, calling it an emotionally emotive term. So that really isn't a good term to use. And I don't know what you call them if you don't call them what they are. What would you call Palestinians if you don't call them Palestinians? So, I mean, her comments are really absurd, claiming the regime is acting legally and not wanting even to mention the word Rohingya. She really betrays the principles that she espoused when she gave her Nobel laureate address over a generation ago, Michael.
And at the same time, we've got mainstream politicians and media speaking out a lot more. In my country, the Prime Minister is being pressured to take away her status as an honorary Canadian citizen, and there's been talk about taking away his Nobel Peace Prize. Do you think these are examples of progress on the part of mainstream politicians and mainstream media from abroad, that they are changing their tune with regard to the or seemingly coming to the defense of the Rohingyans?
Well, I think the outrage about what's going on with the Rohingyas is so extreme that it gets a little bit of press and it just picks up steam, I think, Michael. So it's hard to ignore the fact that these people are being slaughtered. About the only time Palestinians get a lot of press is when Israel goes to war with Gaza, which happened three times since December 2008. Then it gets a lot of press, and you even get Palestinians being interviewed on mainstream media, quoted in the New York Times and the Washington Post. And at the same time, I'm surprised that there have been some major media commentaries, the Washington Post, I think the New York Times, I'm sure others, are very sympathetic to the Rohingyas and very upset at Suu Kyi for what she's doing and what she's not doing. You know, this thing could blow over. The Rohingyas have been persecuted for many decades, and it goes in fits and spurts. It can go on for a while, weeks or months, then it can subside, and then it can pick up again. So maybe in the weeks ahead, if this if the current abuses subside, maybe that will go out of the headlines, and there won't be any more stories about them, and no more criticism of Suu Kyi. And it's easy how the media can simply forget things or simply thrust them down the memory hole. I mean, this happened so many times, Michael. The fact, a good example that sticks in my mind always is that Iraq, Saddam Hussein, destroyed his WMDs, and his son-in-law, Kumail, what's his name? Hussein Kamel, interviewed, among other places, on CNN, saying that, I mean, he was the guy in charge of getting rid of the weapons program, and he said, on CNN, he said they were all destroyed. Well, of course, that was forgotten ahead of the run-up to the war in 2003. So the same thing could happen to the Rohingyas, Michael. There could be a lot of sympathy for them now. There could be a lot of criticism about Suu Kyi's policies and comments and everything else. And then some weeks or months from now, it can all be forgotten, and everything will be swept under the rug again.
I'm kind of fascinated by the fact that this figure has been such a huge icon, the Nobel Peace Prize and the very, very favorable attention she got, being compared to figures like Nelson Mandela, for example. And I'm just thinking about this idea of the celebrity as a tool of empire. Another example that comes to mind, and please correct me if you think this is off base, but I remember back at the time of the 2004 Orange Revolution where Viktor Yushchenko, who was an opposition leader, and he was, he'd gotten this skin condition, and he too had become, gotten iconic status, at least for a time. And so then shortly after that, there were new elections, and he rose to power. Can I get you some of the thoughts about, the celebrity, at least in Western media circles, and that role that it plays in enabling U.S. imperial interest?
Oh, indeed. Although Yushchenko was not an iconic figure by any means, and I believe it was Yanukovych.
Well, he was at the time, was he not? Just around the time of the 2004 election. It just seems Yushchenko, to me, I'm not saying that he was somebody, but that he was in the Western press. There were very sympathetic portrayals of the man around that time.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. There's no question about that, Michael. America's Orange Revolution. So the press will support the candidate that America supports, so they'll build him up. I mean, this guy Saakashvili in Georgia, I mean, an absolute scoundrel. I mean, a Stalinesque figure, a Hitlerian figure, and supported by Western media. And that was back then, the Rose Revolution in Georgia. So Yushchenko, the same thing. And I think it was Yanukovych who was deposed in 2004. Then deposed again. He came back from the dead, so to speak, and deposed again in 2014, and now living in Russia with a warrant for his arrest in Ukraine, which will never be exercised. But you're right, Michael. Your comments are very well taken.
Yeah. And I, of course, since you did come out with the book Flashpoint in Ukraine, I figure that, some of these sorts of sentiments are still in the minds, that the important role of public relations and Aung San Suu Kyi in particular, had such a positive portrayal, in the international press, or at least in the Western press. And so I'm just wondering what, you have any thoughts of if she is somehow is she a media fabrication, or how do you position her in relation to other celebrities, if I can call them that, or icons that have been presented to us in the Western press?
I put it this way, Michael. Whatever she may have been before, whatever kind of person, whatever she might have believed in, if you go back to the early 1990s or earlier, her father, a very important figure in Burma, I guess, it was Myanmar in those days. You mentioned since 1948, I didn't know the date. But whatever she was then, she's an entirely different person now in what she is and what she stands for. So she wasn't the real thing all along. You either are what you are and you stay what you are, but if you change along the way for the worst, then you never were good in the first place, in my mind. I think it's one thing to be less than noble and somehow get religion and become a much more noble figure later on. I think that, to me, is an acceptable way to be. But to put on noble credentials and then later on completely betray them, and we're not talking about minor stuff. We're talking about what I call slow-motion genocide in Myanmar, which really is that. I mean, these people are just being slaughtered and brutalized. Their women are being raped. There's just horrible stuff going on. That is just unacceptable for anybody who claims to be a Democrat and claims to be on the right side of issues to suddenly either ignore what's going on or being on the wrong side of it. She certainly is not supporting the Rohingyas. And to me, being part of the government in Myanmar, she's supporting it, which makes her a criminal. So she never was the real thing all along. That's my belief.
Well, what do you make of the fact that the international community is noticing the Rohingyas, but maybe not the Yemen, you know, the people of Yemen or your other you know, peoples who equivalently deserve some consideration on the part of those of us who care about human rights and democracy and such?
Oh, indeed, Michael, and it's one ethnic group after another.
But the point is that the Rohingyan crisis is getting more recognition apparently than other equivalent or even worse scenarios. So what do you make of that?
Well, of course, you'd have to add at the moment, because you could go back 6 months and nobody talked about the Rohingyas, and maybe 6 months from now nobody will talk about them again. Maybe it'll come up again some other time in the future, but I think it's a short-lived recognition of the plight of these people. The only people that seem to stay in the spotlight a little bit are the Palestinians. I say a little bit because the only time they really get attention is when Israel goes to war with Gaza or there's something major happening in the West Bank or East Jerusalem. Otherwise, the Palestinians get very little play. But they still get some play, especially with the BDS movement and so on. But whether it's the Kurds, the only reason the Kurds are getting play now, or earlier when they wanted to demonize Saddam Hussein for the crimes he committed against them, so they built up the plight of the Kurds then way back. And now the Kurds are being used by Washington as a proxy force against the Syrians. They're not fighting the Syrian government yet. Been a couple of clashes, which could get much more serious. But they're operating illegally along with terrorists in the so-called Free Syrian Army. So many different names, the Free Syrian Army, which to me is just a terrorist organization. Any group in Syria, in another country, supported by America against the government is a terrorist organization. So the Kurds are getting played because it's going along with America, but the Kurds could go back into oblivion again if suddenly they're not needed by Washington anymore. And the Yemenis, of course, are a very important issue, maybe the most persecuted country in the world. With bombs falling every day, the persecution of the Rohingyas is absolutely despicable. The Myanmar government isn't bombing them. I mean, slow motion killing them. Well, I guess the people in Yemen are being slow motion killed as well. But you get terror bombing going on all the time. And now Trump has picked up the terror bombing, either U.S. warplanes or drones or both, conducting raids in Yemen. So these people are just devastated, and they're enduring starvation, diseases that aren't being treated, a terrible cholera epidemic that's expanding. I think the last number I saw was about 600,000 people affected. I mean, this is just utter devastation. And what kind of play are they getting? Very little. I can't say nothing because there's been some, but very, very little.
Okay. Well, we're just about the end of our time, but I just wanted to give you a chance to promote. You've got a website. It's not just the blog site. You've got a StephenLenman.org?
Yes, it's a new website. It's been up since June, so about 3 months it's been operating. StephenLenman.org, and I keep all my articles there. I set up a blog many years ago only as a place to store all my articles in one place, and it turned out that other people found it, and now I have a website, and people use it. I'm delighted about that. I post my articles on it all the time, and I'm delighted with important websites like Global Research supporting what I do.
Stephen Lenman, thanks for joining us.
Michael, thank you so much.
We've been speaking with independent journalist, blogger, and broadcaster Stephen Lenman. As you just heard, his website, where most of his articles are stored, is at StephenLenman.org. And you can also hear his show, the Progressive Radio Hour, which is airs on the Progressive Radio Network.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
The Rohingya crisis has gotten prominent attention in recent weeks. On Wednesday, September 13th, it got top billing during a press conference at which UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke to reporters on the occasion of the 72nd session of the General Assembly. Here were his remarks on the crisis.
We have a very busy week ahead. Global leaders will gather here next week at a time when our world faces major threats. First, the situation in Myanmar. Grievances that have been left to fester for decades have now escalated beyond Myanmar's borders, destabilizing the region. The humanitarian situation is catastrophic. When we met last week, there were 125,000 Rohingya refugees who had fled into Bangladesh. That number has now tripled to nearly 380,000. Many are staying in makeshift settlements or with host communities who are generally sharing what they have. But women and children are arriving hungry and malnourished. I urge all countries to do what they can for humanitarian assistance to be provided. As you know, I wrote an official letter to the Security Council to express my concern. And I welcome the Council's decision to discuss this crisis today. I have condemned the attacks made by the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army. But in Rakhine State, there have been disturbing reports of attacks by security forces against civilians, which are completely unacceptable. Aid activities by UN agencies and international non-governmental organizations have been severely disrupted. I call on the Myanmar authorities to suspend military action, end the violence, uphold the rule of law, and recognize the right of return of all those who had to leave the country.
The Rohingya are a minority Muslim group numbering around 1 million inhabiting Myanmar's Rakhine State. According to UN statistics, more than 370,000 Rohingya have fled to Bangladesh to escape violence since August 25th, according to the United Nations, an average of almost 20,000 a day. On Wednesday, September 13th, the UN Security Council issued a statement acknowledging attacks on Myanmar security forces, but condemning the subsequent violence directed at Rohingya population, and called for, quote, immediate steps to end the violence in Rakhine, de-escalate the situation, and re-establish law and order, ensure the protection of civilians, unquote. Ethnic cleansing is the charge being directed at the Myanmar government and formerly venerated head of state Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi. But of course, as is frequently the case when it comes to human rights abuses highlighted in the mainstream press, there is more going on behind the scenes. Making her debut on the Global Research News Hour radio show is Whitney Webb. She is a contributor to Mint Press News and has written for several news organizations in both English and Spanish. Her stories have been featured on Zero Hedge, The Anti-Media, 21st Century Wire, and True Activist, among others. She recently authored an article for Mint Press, which places the Rohingya crisis in a geopolitical context. She joins us now from southern Chile in Temuco. So, Whitney Webb, welcome to the Global Research News Hour.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Now, the name of your article is Oil, Gas, Geopolitics Guide U.S. Hand in Playing the Rohingya Crisis. You note that China borders Myanmar to the northeast. Could you explain the economic and strategic significance of these pipelines, which you mentioned, from the standpoint of Western and particularly U.S. aims in the region?
Right. So the Shuai Gas Pipelines, well, that's what the name of the oil field is called, named after the Burmese former leader of the junta that was there for a long time. So these are, there's two pipelines. There's one that's natural gas and there's one that's oil. The natural gas pipeline has been operational since 2014. Construction began on both in around 2011, not that long after, a few years after the the oil and the gas. The gas was discovered near there. The oil pipeline still is not operational. It's expected to become operational later this year. And honestly, though the gas pipeline is of course of major benefit to China, the oil pipeline is definitely much more geopolitically strategic, mainly because 80% of China's oil currently, meaning like its imported oil from the Middle East and Africa, travels very far through the Strait of Malacca, which is between Malaysia, Singapore, and Indonesia, and then crosses through the South China Sea and then arrives to China. And of course, as many people know, there are lots of disputed areas in the South China Sea. The U.S. has definitely made that a sort of a hot spot, if you will, between Chinese and U.S. relations and Chinese and U.S. interests in the region. So China, with the completion of this oil pipeline in Myanmar, will be able to avoid any potential conflicts that could arise were the U.S. and China, for example, to enter into a major geopolitical conflict of some type. You know, the U.S., because of its naval bases there, would be able to impose a blockade on the Straits of Malacca. And this would, of course, prevent 80% of Chinese oil from arriving. So now you would just have that oil traveling to the coast of Myanmar and then to the being pumped into the pipeline and then traveling to China that way, giving China the ability to circumvent that major strategical advantage that the U.S. currently holds. And of course, the article that you referenced that I wrote recently is that this is a major piece of the puzzle of why there is sudden interest in the Rohingya crisis, which has honestly been ongoing for over a century, and in terms of its most recent escalation has started around like late last year, and also in 2011 as well, and those were largely absent from the news. Mm-hmm. But this time is apparently different, and a lot of it most likely has to do with the fact that the Chinese oil pipeline is about to go live in the next few months.
Yeah. You mentioned that the oil pipelines have yet to be completed. Is there any specific reason why has the construction been impeded in some way, or are they going according to plan and it's simply not getting completed on
Well, it's been complicated for several reasons. One of them is that Myanmar has several ethnic conflicts, not just the Rohingya issue. In the states bordering China as well, there are significant civil wars, if you will, that are still ongoing in the region. So you have had that sort of conflict as one part of it. You also have strong local opposition in some areas to the pipeline, and you have significant opposition, for example, in the Rakhine state, which is where the Rohingya live. You've had them complain in large amounts of protests of this minority in particular, claiming that the project has polluted rivers, it's destroyed private property, and it's made it impossible for the local fishermen to earn a living by polluting the water, or waters being the coastal areas being crowded by boats, like oil tankers or gas tankers and whatnot, and that it's made it impossible for them, the people that were there before the pipeline, to work. So there's been lots of anti-pipeline demonstrations and unrest. And of course, China is well aware that this can have an impact on their infrastructure projects in Myanmar, because they had a dam project in 2011, and that was closer to the border of China, and that was shut down because of the strong public opposition. So you've definitely had public opposition and protests and things like that complicating issues, causing complications for the construction of these two pipelines.
Okay. Now, what distinguishes the Rohingya is that they are considered like, unlike the other local ethnic and other, you know, farmers,
right,
and other interests, the Rohingya aren't considered nationalist Myanmar nationals. And,
right, they have no citizenship. Right.
Okay, and so that's figuring into this whole struggle, and maybe giving the Myanmar government perhaps a freer hand. But I mean,
yeah, I would say so, because I mean, they don't really have, they're not, they the Myanmar government doesn't have to really respect their rights the same way because they're not considered citizens. So they aren't afforded the same protections that any other Myanmar citizen, official citizen, is given.
Mm-hmm.
And, so that's definitely true.
Yeah, and of course the Myanmar government does have an incentive in having this pipeline completed.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because the plan is that they're going to receive, when both are completed, over $7 million per year just in right-of-way fees. And that's not even counting that the Ministry of Energy, they're like the state energy company, has large stakes in these pipelines as well. Not majority stakes, but significant stakes.
Okay.
And they also own several blocks of the gas field, which is in, by the way, the gas field is in the ocean. It's in the bay, so it's like set off in blocks, and several of those blocks are owned by Myanmar State Energy Company.
Okay, now the Myanmar government is claiming to respond to attacks from militants, and
right.
Could you maybe explain what you understand about this group, the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army?
Right. So they're ARSA for short, and it's much easier to say the acronym than the entire name. So anyway, they've been called the insurgency by the government. And, they've sort of been portrayed in the international media, CNN, Al Jazeera, you know, those type of outlets have sort of portrayed them as freedom fighters and whatnot, and that they're a local response to the longstanding state suppression against this minority group. But actually, there's a lot more going on here if you look at who ARSA really is. I mean, they're led by a Pakistani national whose last name is Junjuni. And he, prior to coming to Myanmar, worked as an imam in Saudi Arabia of the Wahhabi sect, which if anyone follows sort of like terrorist insurgencies around the world, they're almost all Wahhabist, which is a minority sect, if you will, in Islam, that is the state religion of Saudi Arabia, essentially. And it's generally considered very extremist. So you have, this man, Junjuni, who's leading the group, in nominally leading the group anyway, but the group has openly been admitted by the international media, Reuters, the Associated Press and whatnot, as being financed by both Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, though not specifically who is financing it, but the money is coming from there, and that you have a committee of 20 immigrants of the Rohingya group that are headquartered in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, and they claim to be overseeing all of the actions of the group at any given time. So this is kind of a frank admission that this is a sort of a Saudi-funded operation, sort of in the same spirit as numerous other insurgencies, if you will, or terrorist groups that are active in various other countries that are being destabilized at any given time. Syria, the Philippines, they get around. Mm. So anyway, so ARSA has been directly responsible for the crackdown on these, on the civilians, right? Because every time the military has gone around and burned villages or killed innocent people, it's allegedly, at least, been directly in response to ARSA attacks on military bases. And if you look at a map, there's one that I included in my article of the pipelines and the military bases. There's tons of military installations that follow the pipeline through its entire stretch through the country. So, there's a lot of military buildup in these areas, and you're having ARSA lead, strategically planned, obviously, attacks that aren't really meant to do anything. They're not really meant to, remove these the military installations in Rakhine State, but they're definitely creating the pretext for retaliation. And it's also interesting to notice that Saudi Arabia is also spending billions of dollars constructing Wahhabi mosques right in the areas where the Rohingya are fleeing in Bangladesh, assumably to keep ARSA a very notable but influenceable force in the region for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and I'm just, when you talk about these Wahhabi groups, I mean, I'm very much reminded, I mean, you mentioned Syria, for example, and
right.
But I'm kind of reminded of the Yugoslavia situation, because if memory serves, there was a lot of criticism of the Serbian government for ethnic cleansing without acknowledging the attacks that prompted those retaliations. And so I'm seeing a sort of
right.
the same pattern at work here in particular.
Well, it's a pattern that gets, you know, repeated frequently. I mean, ethnic cleansing in terms of what the UN will call ethnic cleansing, or the U.S. Or even the corporate media will call ethnic cleansing, is very selective. You know, at the same time, you have this Rohingya crisis going on, which has been dominating headlines for the past month or so. You know, you have this massive crisis in Yemen that's like supposed to be the worst humanitarian crisis in recent history, and you see very minimal coverage on that. And that has been called genocide on the part of the Saudis against the Yemeni people. And then you have, you know, ethnic cleansing examples, honestly, the world over. You know, in South America, for example, you have Colombia. They deprived their largest indigenous group of its entire water source, and you've had 14,000 children die there in 5 years. And there's been no media coverage of that at all. Right. So in terms of the selectivity here, you know, it's only when calling something ethnic cleansing, whether it is or not, serves a purpose. And that's what we have here. You know, it's because of the longstanding persecution of the Rohingya. It's very likely that this is in the same lines as those other things, but it's being treated differently because there are different interests that are that stand to benefit from the characterization of the situation as such.
So I'm looking at this, the leader, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Aung San Suu Kyi, who just a few years ago was being, you know, venerated and
right.
And
well, she has been for years.
Yes,
in that way, yeah.
But you know, she is very much a tool of U.S. Western interests. Yet she's supporting this pipeline. So are her loyalties divided in some sense, or what do you make of this attack, you know, via these Wahhabi groups against her authority?
Right. Well, I think it's, you know, it's complicated for her because she, you know, especially the time when she was receiving so much funding from the U.S., she didn't technically have political power. Her political power was in the vested in the fact that she was not nominally the leader of the country, that she was an opposition leader. You know, she was, has been for years received, well, her political party, the National League for Democracy, they have received millions and millions and millions from the U.S. government, USAID, the National Endowment for Democracy, and what have you. So, I mean, it was largely expected that once she became president, that she would begin serving U.S. interests. You know, and she's done that to some extent. I mean, once she became president, I mean, the government contracts and whatnot that were being offered, a lot more of them went to U.S. corporations. Of course, this, you could argue that that was because the Obama administration waited to lift sanctions on Myanmar until after she became president, even though that was around 20, that was last year. And Myanmar has ostensibly been a democracy since 2011. But, you know, you have a sort of a case here where Suu Kyi has decided to pursue, it seems like anyway, Myanmar's state interests instead of the U.S.'s state interests in the area, because she has, during her presidency, definitely forged close ties with China. She's been to Beijing twice. But in contrast, she's rejected invitations from U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and hasn't really, like, been very actively engaged with the Trump administration anyway, so she's definitely been focused on Chinese stuff. In recent visits, she's like praised China for their support for her government and the peace process, because obviously China has a vested interest in things being quite calm in Myanmar so that their economic projects or their infrastructure projects can continue without issue. And the U.S. probably didn't necessarily plan on this. They probably expected, because of all the money they had given her, and basically, you know, the reason she exists as a political figure has a lot to do with their support over the years. But she has ended up serving the interests of her own country at this time. I argue in my piece that the U.S. is trying to play both sides of the situation here. That on one hand, you know, they know that the Saudis are funding this insurgency that is causing this crisis. You know, they are allowing, you know, the corporate media and whatnot to report excessively on this issue, bring it under a microscope. You know, there's this this effort to discredit Suu Kyi in the news right now. Whether or not it's warranted, I'm not really saying. I, you know, plenty of reasons to criticize any world leader. But on the other hand, you have the U.S. coming in on the backside to Myanmar's government saying, hey, we're not really going to get involved because we want to support you, but let's work more closely militarily. And this is the back door through which the U.S. is seeking to have its influence, because if you're following what the Trump administration has been doing lately, it's very military dominated. I mean, the Trump administration right now is basically run by a trio of generals, a junta, if you will.
Yeah.
Because it's essentially become that in some ways. So a lot of the foreign policy is through the military. And you see that same sort of thing going on here.
So how do you see this situation playing out then, if Aung San Suu Kyi decides to continue to govern in the national interest as opposed to these Western interests? I mean, would we be looking at a regime change a la Syria sort of operation, a Balkanization?
Well, I don't think it'll be like Syria, because in Assad's case, you know, he's very independent of Western things, and his greatest allies are the greatest rival nations of the U.S., Iran, and Russia. In this case, I think if the crisis gets so bad to a certain point, I don't think Suu Kyi would have the same problem that someone like Assad would, for example, and asking for U.S. military assistance over Chinese military assistance, for example, which is what the U.S. is certainly hoping will happen, and is what they're basically trying to do right now. The National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA of the U.S., if passed in its current form, would, for example, normalize fully the ties between the militaries of Myanmar and the U.S., despite the fact that the Myanmar military, you know, doesn't really have a good reputation right now, Rohingya crisis aside, you know, just because of the junta and its history, the military government that was in Myanmar for so long. But anyway, that would enable the U.S. to provide, just open the floodgates for weapons, technical assistance, logistical assistance, and even military bases in the area, which is what the U.S. ultimately wants, because you have the U.S.-China containment policy playing out on a massive scale right now, where pretty much almost every Chinese border state, except for Russia, obviously, there are either major tensions there or regime change threats. If the government is not already friendly to U.S. interests, and if it is friendly to U.S. interests, they have been buying up U.S. arms at, I don't know if I'd say historic rates, but it's definitely huge jumps. Big examples there are Taiwan, Japan, and South Korea. But you also have the same thing going on with Vietnam, and you have a whole bunch of, it's just a mess, honestly. But so, you know, Myanmar is no different, because China sees Myanmar as, you know, as a strategic border country, because it's, you know, has so many economic ties with China, which it has had historically as well, and serves a strategic purpose. And they've also even China's also talked about establishing its own naval base in Myanmar, which the U.S. Does not want, obviously, at all.
Yes, that that ongoing Asia pivot. It's
right,
and
that's such a euphemism for what's actually going on.
Yeah.
Pivot sounds so subtle.
And it's interesting. I just maybe just before we wrap up, I'm kind of curious to know about what China's options are, because they are also facing something similar happening in the Philippines. Interestingly enough, you know, the other area in the region where you're seeing this Wahhabist insurgency, and it just, you know, happens to be, you know, fitting into U.S. Imperial aims. So what is China's options in terms of countering this? Can they do anything?
In terms of the containment policy?
Yeah.
As a regional, yeah, okay. You know, it's really complicated because the U.S. is just, like, so on the warpath that, you know, honestly, China and Russia, too, is in a similar situation, have tried to do the diplomatic thing. It seems like, anyway, and just the U.S. Doesn't really abide by the standards to which it holds other nations. You know, it sort of, like, runs its own show when it comes to these sort of things. So I think China's really in a tricky spot. What they're trying to do is not to provoke the U.S., and they're trying to, you know, keep things manageable. But eventually, the U.S. is going to just start acting extremely irrationally as it continues to lose its hegemony in the world. But I think what China's only real option is actually what it's doing right now, which is advancing the de-dollarization of its economy and of the BRICS economies as well. So you have China, for example, recently announced that it would offer a triad of oil, yuan, and gold, basically future oil contracts that are convertible, priced in the yuan, the Chinese currency, that is convertible into gold. And this is a huge blow to the petrodollar. China also holds all of these U.S. foreign reserves. They hold large amounts of U.S. debt, and they've been buying up gold to back up its own currency for years. You know, so I think China is taking a much more subtle route, in that they're going they're using, you know, economic warfare to retaliate when they can, but not overtly. You know, it's all very behind the scenes. And I think you also have sort of like a, they're planning also for this trade war with the U.S. because the Trump administration, like, has pretty much said a bunch of times that they're trying to declare trade war on China without actually saying it. So I think China's focus is definitely more on economic than political right now. But China is trying to, you know, they just opened their first military base in Africa, I think, not that long ago. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to expand, you know, their military as they can. But obviously it's not the same thing that the U.S. is currently doing, which has like over 800 military bases in the world. China just opened its first. But they're trying to, you know, do what they can, but it's not, it's, you know, when the U.S. has dominated things for so long and is like, has their hands in every pie, it's kind of hard to really protect yourself fully from that. I mean, honestly, the best bet is what they're doing now, like I said, which is economic stuff against the dollar, which protects them if they were to be kicked out of, you know, the SWIFT banking system, for example, which has been threatened to them, and a few other things.
Okay. Well, Whitney Webb, I want to thank you very much for your time and for this providing this analysis for our listeners.
Yeah, no problem. It was fun. So okay. Thanks.
Great. We've been speaking with Whitney Webb. She is a contributor to Mint Press News and is also published on a number of other sites, including Zero Hedge, The Anti-Media, 21st Century Wire, and True Activist, and she spoke to us from Temuco, Chile. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.